history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories there that really ought to be told. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, I'm in Fresno, California, with 96-year-old Joe Garabedian, Army veteran of World War II, recipient of the Purple Heart, also an owner of a combat infantry badge. We're going to find out how long he lasted in combat and what he had to endure to make it home and start a business that's still with us today and bigger than ever. But Joe, let's go back to your early days. You grew up on a farm, 20-acre farm in Fowler, California, in the Great Central Valley. What was life like back then? How different was it from what we know here today in 2020?
Well, I have to correct. This was in Lone Star. I called it an oasis. We had a canal running on one side. We had the railroad running on the other side, so it was kind of civilization. Thank God for the canal. I learned how to swim, and that came in very handy in the service.
Here I thought I'd been everywhere in the San Joaquin Valley and knew every little spot on the map. I don't think I've ever heard of Lone Star.
Lone Star is 7 miles from Fresno and 7 miles from Sanger. Right in the center, there was a depot there, and it was Lone Star Grammar School on Fowler Avenue as the Santa Fe Railroad track.
And you had a big family.
Yeah, a family of 12. I was number 9. It was very interesting every night to have 12 people in the house. And we all had games to play. It was fun. We had 3 cows, 2 horses, 15 sheep. Armenians all love sheep, lambs, so... We had plenty of chickens and a couple of goats. We never were hungry. We worked. We learned how to farm. And from there on, my brothers went on to town to work. I was left to run the ranch. And when I graduated, I went to work at commercial manufacturing the next day and learned how to weld and do torch work or whatever. Worked there for about a year and a half, and I got drafted.
Do you remember in those early years having some ideas, hey, when I grow up, I'm going to do this or this? Did you have some of those dreams that young boys sometimes have?
Oh, I had a dream that I was going to work at commercial manufacturing for the rest of my life. Never dreamt of starting a business or anything like that. I was very happy that I found a spot because jobs were a little hard to find at that time at 2 bits an hour, 25 cents an hour. Mm-hmm. And that was very interesting. 4 of those and you got a dollar.
And, you know, most of the people listening to this didn't live through the Great Depression. It's really hard for them to fathom what that might have been like. I just heard you say that you had everything you needed out on the farm with all the animals you raised and the crops and all that. But do you remember seeing some devastation around you or seeing times change?
Definitely. You give a farmer a go-ahead and they'll produce whatever you need. We produced almost everything. I don't remember of anything that we bought from town except probably some special meat orders or something like that. The rest of it we produced ourselves. Our garden on that 20 acres was one whole acre. And my mother had, by the time fall came, she would have 4 levers of 12 foot in the cellar where they put all the canned foods. And we had canned foods, we had dried foods, we had bins full of flour. That's why I called it an oasis.
It sounds like it. I'm sure that as one of those 10 kids and one of the younger ones, you probably still had a lot of chores to do, right?
Yes, milking cows morning and night until when they'd calve. Then naturally you didn't milk them for a little bit. But otherwise you had that chore every morning, every night. It's a little bit hard to qualify for school projects. I'd have to tell my dad, will you please sign this contract so I can get to play football? And he said, no, there's no money in football. I don't want you to get hurt. Well, I'd catch him when he's reading the Bible and catch him when he's starting to cry. And I'd say, will you please sign this for me? And he'd sign it. So next thing I know, I was on the football team. Buying somebody else's used football shoes. But you know what I loved about football? Walking on the concrete with the girls watching. That's what the interesting part was.
The heads would turn, huh?
Yeah.
What position did you play?
Right guard and right tackle.
Who is your big rival?
Sanger, Selma. Selma was the one that ruined us.
They ruined you.
It was on the kickoff. They run the ball back, and that was it. That's why the score finished 6-0. Otherwise, we would have won our gold footballs.
I'm thinking about just the timing of everything. Since you were the class of 1942 at Fowler High School, that means that just about in the middle of your senior year, the world changed a little bit. Do you remember December 7th and where you were?
Oh, well, I remember. I was driving a Fortson tractor on the back of the 20 acres. They motioned me on, and I stopped, and they said, this is about 1 o'clock in the afternoon for us here. And when they said what they did, it was very hard for me to believe because our neighbors were Japanese, and we were friendly with all the Japanese here. We went to school with a bunch of them, and it's just unbelievable. And we went back to school. A speaker came one day, and he said, none of you boys will ever see action. Well, he was very wrong. We got right in the middle of it.
I just always want to imagine what it's like for you. I'm sure that coming from an Armenian family, you had grown up with stories of the persecution that the Armenian people had faced that drove so many of them to the valley. Your family came over before 1900. But I'm sure you had felt some of that, or at least heard some of that, that there'd been some discrimination or some persecution of Armenians?
All during our grammar school, up through the 5th and 6th grades, we were persecuted by certain people. We would eat our lunches behind trees because they were wrapped in Betsy Ross wrappers that we saved off the loaf of bread, or sometimes Armenian bread, sometimes Armenian cheese. We just took it. Whatever they gave us, we just didn't fight or nothing, just carried it on. Thank God. And today we married each other.
They picked on you and called you names and stuff, or what?
Yeah, Fresno Indian. But as far as playing in sports, we were equal with anybody else.
And I bring that up just as I'm thinking about watching what then happened to your Japanese-American friends. Because as you just said, these are your classmates, these are your teammates in sports, and then they're gone.
Yes, I had to deliver their strawberries to the association because they could raise them, but they couldn't go to downtown. This was kind of the bad part of my. I visited them at the
Assembly Center?
Yes, right here in Fresno. At the fairgrounds. I visited them before they shipped out. But when they came back, some of them took a pretty good beating. They had to sell their properties and such. Some of them just ran the ranches for them, which was a very kind thing to do. It was something that wore off. Everybody got back friendly again.
Well, and here it wouldn't be too long till you're over fighting Imperial Japan. But these are Americans. These are kids born in America just like you. As I said, they're your classmates. And I want to ask you about that because you just said something. And people who know the story, they know that, you know, initially their movement was restricted. Then they were sent away from the West Coast inland to these internment camps. So when they couldn't go to one side of the freeway, you volunteered to take their goods to market so they could still make the money from their farm.
Yes, Yamamoto. His father and my father were the first ones in the neighborhood. Later on, the Japanese had trouble buying property, but before then, he had bought the 20 acres, so they were good people.
So they had the farm adjacent to your farm?
20 acres in between.
Okay. This is just such a different thing than most of us have gone through, so I just don't want to miss anything that's of value or importance to you. You're a teenager. You're in high school. Was it hard to wrap your mind around what was happening to those people?
It was sad because they were our friends, but it all got straightened out. But some of them took a hell of a beating.
Many of them lost everything they had.
Yep. There were a lot of greedy people out that took advantage of it.
Well, it's good to hear about some of the exceptions and the kindness you extended to them. And so then you finish out high school, and had you thought at all at that point when you graduated, had you thought at all about getting into the service?
No, because I was in 41, my junior year, I worked at commercial manufacturing, so I knew I was going to work there for the rest of my life. But after being there another year and a half, I had to leave. I thought I was going to join the Navy, but I was colorblind. I went through 19 years of my life without knowing that I'm colorblind. And now I remember why, when I was picking peaches for the Lehman family, I'd hear the owner hollering out, who's picking these green peaches? Because the red peaches were taken to the market. So after I got discharged, I went and told Adam, I said, Adam, I'm the guy that was picking your peaches green. I said, that's not the only place I had trouble. When we started business on 220 electricity, there's four wires. One is green and one is gray, and I had a little problem. We did hook up electricity. And one day I was putting in tail lights on the truck, and the wife was waiting to pick somebody up. And he says, haven't you got that light backwards? No, I said, I got the red backwards. No, though I had just the opposite. I had the black backwards, and reflector was forward. So that's... It was pretty bad. I saw the signal okay because I know the top light is red and the bottom one is green, but I got through. But that was because of this reading the semaphore, which was so oftenly used in the Navy.
Right. That's how they communicated.
For communicating. But I went to Dr. Pomeroy. I says, you got to give me some pills. I'm colorblind. Hey, leaned back and laughed. He says, son, you're born that way. He says, there's nothing you can do about it. But they put me in Army 2, which goes the same place that Army 1 goes, but I could see camouflage better than the average person can. I never put it to use, but I never had that trouble on colors in the service.
Well, there's something else that I want to make sure we bring up here, because you did end up in the Army after you tried to go in the Navy, but you didn't have to. You could have stayed right here in California because your farm was something that the nation needed. People needed food. The soldiers overseas needed all those raisins from here in the valley. Why didn't you think a deferment for agricultural purposes was the way to go?
Four other of my friends did. I couldn't. I was coming out of a bachelor spell at that time. I told my dad, I said, I have to go. I won't be able to stay here. And thank God I went, because I love this country. I love what it's done. I'm sorry for all these people that are protesting now. If they knew any better, I wish the protesters would just turn around, go home before the door could hit them in the back. It just hurts me. This is the most wonderful, beautiful country in the world. You know how many people we've lost during all our wars, especially the Civil War, brothers fighting brothers. I don't like the protesting that's going on.
You end up in the Army. Do you remember what your expectations were? What did you think it was going to be like?
Every morning when you wake up, you dig a slit trench as long as your body and as wide as your body. And it rained so much in those islands that water would fill up to the top and start to flow off. So you're soaked in there. And the order is you do not stand up to go to the bathroom. I met one of the guys that got shot in our outfit with a .45. He didn't die. He stood up to go to the bathroom. And when I saw him on the hospital ship, I said, hey, Bill, I said, what the hell are you doing here? And he said, oh, some sniper got me. I knew what had happened, but I never told him that one of our guys saw him stand up, so he got shot. Mm. Now, the foxholes, wet. You're wet. You're there until the sun comes up. We had set our machine guns, 8 machine guns, 2 feet off the ground so that it would shoot over our infantry. And when the Japanese would come in with their bonsai, like 200 at a time, we had our machine guns all set ahead of time. So one guy would sit and stay awake. Now, believe me, we fell asleep in that water. Your time was up. You'd take a handful of mud and throw it and hit the other guy, so his turn to go to bed, and it's your turn to stay up. Thank God I had only 8 days of this.
Yeah, we're going to hear why it was limited to 8 days. I'm also interested, too, in what led up to your heading overseas. Because I know you weren't a machine gunner right out of the gate. You have to go through training. You're learning a lot of different things. And some of the guys I've talked to had a more jarring experience in training than others. What was it like for you?
We went right direct from Fresno to Monterey and then took a train to Camp White, Oregon, and put right into the company. That company was on bivouac, which means regular war experiences. So those of us that were put in there to fill up the holes were there for about 2 weeks before they came in. And I knew enough not to try to out-talk these guys and argue them, because that's a time for you getting in trouble. They came in, we got all fit in. I was on 383rd for a month or so. And then, for some reason, they chose a number of us to put into the mortar platoon and mortar and the machine gun outfit. And I was fortunate enough to get into the machine gun outfit. And one main thing that I remember, they threw out a 2-inch rope from the ship to shore. This is in practice. And we had 20-foot waves. You got one hand on the rope, you got the other hand on the tripod over your neck. And thank God I did not lose mine. I said to myself, Garabedian, you will not lose this tripod. Some of the mortar guys lost their bases because they're so big. When the wave hits it, it just throws them all over the place. I'll never forget that. You had to breathe only when you thought you were in air. You didn't know whether the water is still in close to your mouth or where. Anyhow, we had a bunch of those occasions like that.
Those practice landings were on the Central California coast? by San Luis Obispo?
Some of them were here in San Luis Obispo. Some of them was in down where the Marines are, Camp Pendleton. And that's one where we had to climb to the top. I don't know what it was, 20 foot, 30 foot up. And you got 70 pounds of pack on you. And you're climbing up a net rope ladder, and you got to walk across the top or crawl across the top and start coming back on the other side. And lo and behold, somebody drops his weapon, and the Marines just wouldn't let us live it down. How bad are you guys going to be? How bad are we going to? You guys going to be our supporters? We don't want to fight with you guys. Not if you're going to drop weapons. It's just one. We got our tail out of there and left. It was ugly. But some of the other training was on Oahu, Hawaiian Islands. We spent a month there at Pali Pass, Maui Island. Most of that was amphibious. I didn't know what the word amphibious was until I found out that our spies had gone to Singapore and seen the Japanese landing crafts. Our landing crafts were boats, real boats with keels. But this was a flat bottom, twin diesel engines that were very powerful, that would carry about 50 people. Now, if you got 500 people to a ship, three ships to a division of 15,000, you can see how many trips that coxswain had to take back and forth. Well, fortunately, when we landed on Leyte, there was no beach fighting. We were kind of tickled about that. But the coxswains were very happy, too, because they can back off and bring another load in. You can imagine, they had to make quite a few trips. That was a hectic time of the war, whether you're going to make it or not. And your question was, what do you think about? What do you think about every morning? I'm still alive. Will I be alive tonight? Four of my outfit died. Why am I here? I'm right there. I got shot through my brachial plexus, which are all your nerve center, and come out and just missed my spine.
That sounds pretty serious, doesn't it? There are a lot of people who wouldn't be here if that had gone a little differently, and a business that might not have revolutionized the world's food processing industry the way that Valley Welding and Machine Works has. We're going to touch on that and what it took for Joe Garabedian to recover from his injuries when we come back. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos and a short video with Joe, and Hometown Heroes will come right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with 96-year-old Joe Garabedian of Fresno, California. He served with the Deadeye Division, the 96th Infantry Division in World War II, ending up in a machine gun squad in the 381st Regiment. Did you know what you were getting into? I don't know if people today understand all that went into a machine gun outfit in those days.
Well, whether it's a rifleman or whether it's a machine gunner, you had to tear that machine apart, blindfolded, and put it back together in the dark on a Grand rifle, which is one of the best rifles in the Army because it was automatic and gas-propelled, better even than Germany, who had a bolt action. We never had bolt action. Ours was automatic. You just pulled the trigger. On the machine gun, you have to take it apart, blindfolded, lay the parts down on the table. The most dangerous thing in there is a spring about 16 inches long. You don't pull the trigger when you lift. Well, let me say it like this. I've been saying it for years and years. Bolts forward, covers down. The second gunner puts the belt through. You cock it. That's bolt forward, covers down. And all you got to do is just lift that up. The spring will push it forward. And when it goes forward, the firing pin hits and the power, the blow, pushes it back. So that's 650 rounds times a minute. But we were told, don't sleep on the trigger. You're not supposed to go over fire bursts of six. Every sixth one is a tracer. Fire bursts of six. Fire bursts of six. That's to keep the barrel cool.
Mm-hmm.
It's water cooled. The tube is put down into the ground so the enemy can't see the steam coming up. It produces steam in a short while. But you don't want to hurt your barrel. You have a spare barrel. If you burn it out, and if it gets too hot and burn it out, you have to twist it out, put a new barrel in there, and bring it out and click it back and hope you got the clicks back, because if you make it too tight, the shell will fracture and you have to, you're out of business until you can get it out of there. You've got to put it a little bit short and then tighten it a notch or two. No, I did not think, what am I getting myself into? I was so, please believe me, I was so damn patriotic to see what we were doing. We had plenty of food. We had plenty of ammunition. There was 90,000 troops on the ocean when I was going across.
Mm-hmm.
I was on that ship for 40 days. We stopped up at Mariani for a beer party. What that is you climb down the rope ladder, and they bring some ham sandwiches, and you have a little beer party, and if you're lucky enough, you can get a clean shower, because on the ships, it's all salt water
mm-hmm.
for troops. I was walking around one of the bone piles, junkyard, and I see this can of food, never been opened yet. I figured, you know what, let me take that on the ship with me. So we took some beer with us, going back. And we took our shovels and popped the end off, and it was beautiful. Chip beef. Everybody had a hand in it. We didn't care if we got sick because because it was enjoyable. So, yes, a machine gunner is dangerous. That's why, well, first of all, the officer threw his binoculars. You know, I'm a poor farm kid. Never seen barred binoculars in my life, half decent. So I picked it up and put it inside my shirt after things kind of settled. I took it out and was looking around, and well, zing, right through my shoulder. Mm-hmm. So it was a sniper. Later on at the Army reunions, one of the guys told me, he says, when they found the guy, they counted 60 shots. He was up in the palm tree.
Mm.
So I got up and I started running. I run about 10 feet. The blood is squirting out. I'm hollering, medics, medics, and I fell down. So my medic comes and, Garabinier, where's your medical kit? I said, it's on the Jeep. I said, I didn't want to carry it. So they gave me a shot of morphine. They patched me up. That's the only patching up I got until I got to Hoania, New Guinea. So this is an interesting part. They managed to get me on a stretcher. And a fellow by the name of Medziak out of Chicago, he was underneath the bush. He reached down and grabbed a hold of my stretcher. And one hand pulled me underneath that bush. It took another half hour before they... firing. You don't fire all day long. It just goes in spurts. So then at about 5:30 in the evening, the Jeep came by and they put three of us on and took us back 14 miles to the field hospital. And my God, we got there. When we got a couple hundred feet from there, we had to stretch a cable on a track layer that was there for this purpose, just to pull the Jeeps or the trucks through the mud.
Mm-hmm.
Because the mud was so deep. They actually slid the vehicles through there. They put me in a tent, and the guy says, contending me, he says, where's your dog tag? I says, it left the back on the Jeep. He says, that's a heck of a place to leave it. He says, how am I going to know who you are? Well, it's plain English. I'm Joseph Garabedian, 39421644 is my serial number. Okay, so he put that on a shipping tag, put it around my neck, and that night I was in that tent dark. Just pitch dark. I felt something coming out of my mouth, so I guess it must have been blood. And I took that shipping tag and I wiped my mouth with it. The next morning, when he comes in, somebody comes in to see who I am, tend to me. He said, "Where's your dog tag? How come you got your dog tag all dirty?" I said, "Well, I had to wipe my blood out of my mouth." Well, anyhow, then they took me into the field hospital, cleaned me up, put me on a hospital ship. That afternoon, I was on the way to Hoania. The ship was not a troop ship. It was a roomy, like a passenger ship, but it was a hospital ship. We had beds to sleep in. We had commodes. It took us, I think, I don't know, 2 weeks or so to get there, maybe 3 weeks, I don't know. Had a little constipation problem. So when I got there, the guy that was in charge of me, he says, okay, I've read your orders. Here's your bedpan. I said, what's a bedpan for? He says, you have to use it. I said, I don't like a bedpan. I won't use it. I don't know how to use it. He says, my orders say you have to use it. So I used it. He says, you will never use a bedpan again under my watch. Anyhow, I was there until I think about the 19th of December. I was happy there, even though I got nothing but a turkey tail.
So I'm going to bounce around with you a little bit. The reason I asked about the machine gunner thing, so this is a heavy thing to carry. You've got to carry the barrel, the tripod. Someone's got to carry some ammunition.
Yeah, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, about 5 ammunition bearers.
Uh-huh.
The gunner and the second gunner take turns, but when they get tired, they'll let us handle it, which we enjoyed it. So you got about 4 ammunition bearers. Each can's got 650 rounds a minute, plus the one that is going in. And you don't sleep on it. It's like not like on the movies where they just fall asleep on the trigger. It's the fire bursts at 6 and you stop. You come down a trail real nice. You don't even have to look through a sight because you can see where it's hitting. Every 6th one being a tracer, just automatically you can just bring yourself right down that path. And it's got a good sight at a mile. The M1 rifle was the same shell that used the Garand, the same shell that the machine gunner belt had, and the same shell that fit in the carbine, which was a 15 shell clip.
Well, I'm just curious. I mean, I'm guessing you had to know that the odds are more against you if you're part of a machine gun squad, because you're a bigger target for the enemy. You're the one they want to take out.
But you know, there's a certain thing is, again, please believe me, patriotism that stays with you, and you're living through hell anyhow. You're living through hell anyhow, so you just as well do what the guys did at Gettysburg or where else, or Washington crossing the Delaware. We're all the same people. It's the same country. How this country did this in 250 years, I don't know. But yes, we knew, but you can't say nothing. You can't back out.
Did they tell you this is how long the average machine gunner lasts in combat?
It's in writing. 3 minutes.
3 minutes of combat.
Yes.
You're going to be killed or wounded.
Yeah, in 3 minutes they'll spot you. That's why you want to fire for burst of 6 or 3 or 4 times and then move. You don't stay in the same spot. Now, some of these places that make their surroundings out of concrete and everything else like German did and all that, once you throw a grenade, you got the whole outfit.
So you're 20 years old. You've never been in combat before, and you're landing at Leyte. And this is part of a larger plot because the Americans had been in the Philippines. They'd been either captured or chased out. Thousands of them are on the Bataan Death March. MacArthur gets out of there, but he says, I shall return. And the day that he actually fulfilled that promise was the day you were landed on the same beach?
Yes. We landed on the 20th. On the 27th, we turned left on Tanawan, and then on the 28th, we were going into the Kailing. That evening, when all this action came on and I got wounded, I read where they had to go back 1,000 feet and regroup and start all over again to go into Kailing. That's when most of the fighting started. There wasn't too much fighting before there. On Catman Hill and some of those places there was, it was very slow, but it picked up. They weren't too prepared.
So what was happening right before you got hit?
I was looking through my binoculars like this, behind the gun itself. But there was, just before that, a mortar shell blew up behind us, and actually none of us got any shrapnel, but the noise was deafening. It was rather quiet, but then all it takes is one fake shooter, and you got a bunch of people shooting. I remember the first action we got there, we were shooting up into a palm tree, and in a few seconds, the whole palm tree was pruned. The officer was, stop it, you know. It's amazing how they would be able to hide in a palm tree. There's not that much place to hide up those trees.
And you've made it clear how patriotic you felt, how important this was for you to do this for your country. But as you're entering into combat for the first time in your life, were you scared? Were you nervous? Anxious?
As long as you're whole, you're scared as hell. Well, if you get wounded. Now, when I got wounded, I didn't even think of dying. I don't know why. All I knew is I sprung up, ran about 10 feet, and fell like I said a while ago. You're in it now. You're in it. I didn't get into the tough fighting where they did in Okinawa. So I got letters from some of the guys. They said it was, you think Leyte was hell. This is altogether hell because they had thousands of people. They lost 1,000 soldiers. We lost 17,000. They're ready for us. They're, you know, it's like football, offense, defense. They're on defense. They know your spot. They know exactly. They've got their mortars all tuned in, and they know exactly where it's going to fall.
And when you got hit, what did that feel like?
Like a bee sting. Believe me, it didn't hit any bones. I guess that's why. Like a bee sting.
So it came in not too far from your head, a couple inches.
Right here, yeah.
Right on your left shoulder.
I think he was trying to hit my head.
Good thing he missed. But he didn't miss by much.
No.
So it goes in vertically, almost, on your left shoulder, and exits down near your tailbone, kind
of? No, in the center of my back.
Right in the center of your back.
Half inch from my spine. I'd have been paralyzed.
Yeah.
That shakes me. In fact, it shakes the doctors when they see it, to be that close to the spine.
It's kind of hard to do that. There's a lot of bones that he had to miss.
Well, that's probably where that blood came into my mouth. You know, people ask me, well, how did you get blood through your mouth? I guess it must have been some of that internal injuries.
What about your arm? Did you have the use of that left arm at all?
I didn't have the use of that arm for more than a year. I was in the hospital. From that point on, I got discharged on November 45. We entered the United States and back again on the 2nd of January of 45. I got discharged the end of 45. I got discharged.
Mm-hmm.
My arm was useless. Even now, when the weather gets real cold, this arm is useless because I got a 30% disability on it.
Well, it sounds almost miraculous you were ever able to use it at all.
I use it for everything.
But I'm thinking about the first 30 minutes that you're wounded, because you described it. They get you on a stretcher, but you're still out there, and they're still firing all around you, and your buddy's able to pull you under a bush.
I've often wondered how they got me on, well, how they got me on the stretcher, but Mesiak was the only one under the bush within reach of me, and he pulled it underneath. I guess what happened was they spread out once they got me on the stretcher, and that stretcher is on legs or something, and he's a big, great big Polack, great big Polack. Too bad he had to die. He grabbed me and pulled me underneath.
What do you think would have happened to you if he didn't do that?
They would have nailed me.
They would have seen you.
Yeah. It's hard to say what would have happened. It wasn't too far. But that wasn't very much action, 8 days. Was it worth it? All the training? Now, did the government lose money on me, or did they make?
Well, I think everyone's going to form an opinion about that by the time we're done here. But you had a long journey. I mean, you just said you didn't have the use of your arm for a year.
Yes.
So this is a long time that you're dealing with this daily. When they first get you to a place where they can help, is it sinking into you that you may never be able to use this left arm again?
No, because I was always aggressive. When I came back in 1946, I had my truck and trailer. I was able to use my arm to haul bricks, sand, and gravel for our building. And by February, we were in business. I run the lathe for 13 years. I'd never seen a lathe before. But you learn those things. You're aggressive. It's your chance. You got to do it.
Sounds like you never took anything for granted either.
Listening to my father's stories? No. I'm just thankful that my mother and father were able to come to this country. And not only my mother and father, millions of other people came to this country for a reason. Safety in food. At least they would say that when you go to bed at night, you know that you're going to wake up in the morning.
It's time for another break, but there's more to come with 96-year-old Joe Garabedian, how he went from nearly losing his arm, not to mention his life, to launching a business that's still with us 3/4 of a century later. Valley Welding and Machine Works in Fresno, California continues to grow, providing custom machines, mostly for the dried fruit and nut industries, all over the globe. And what an example it is of a multi-generational family business. If you go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you'll find photos of Joe at that business he started with his two older brothers after returning, wounded from World War II. You'll see him with his three children and three of his grandchildren, all of whom are carrying on that legacy today. By the way, if you've ever worked out on a universal gym machine, your muscles have benefited from something that Joe Garabedian and his crew at VWM helped engineer. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHSmaster will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVD DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com, and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Loeffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a fascinating visit today with Joe Garabedian, 96 years old of Fresno, California. From his childhood on the ranch in Lone Star to playing football at Fowler High School, passing on an agricultural deferment so he could serve in World War II, and making it all of 8 days in combat on the island of Leyte in the Philippines before a sniper's bullet almost ended his life. I think we're getting a pretty clear picture of how resilient Joe is, but I think we ought to dig a little deeper into just what it took to overcome his injuries and build the life he's still enjoying today.
I know this is something that's that you've lived with for more than 75 years.
Yes.
So it doesn't seem like as big of a deal as it might be to someone who hasn't gone through it. But again, you're a 20-year-old kid, and you don't know if you're going to keep your arm or not. Did you ever think they were going to have to amputate?
I knew I'd find a way. No, well, when they, first of all, I used the word parting. I got to part your arm. I kind of figured that's got to mean cutting. I didn't care. You know, yes, I cared, but I was in this barracks. I had my 3 meals a day, and all of a sudden when they told me I was going to ship out about the 19th of December or something like that, I worked at it. These women, different women, worked on me constantly. They broke my knuckles. They broke my, when I say broke, it broke the calcium. I had calcium on every one of my joints, and she'd put her knee up in my arm and pull on it back and forth. This is when I was still in the...
Hollandia?
Yeah. And they'd break it, and it hurt terrible, especially, you know, breaking the fingers like this. I had a half a cast on. It was a full cast. Then they took a skill saw and cut the sides off and put a band around it. Well, at nighttime, when everybody's asleep, I used to take that thing off and just lay my arm down there. And it felt so good. After about an hour or so, I'd put the cast back on. It was a half cast, and I put the band and had a little clip on the end. Nobody knew it. I took it off. Boy, that when they gave me that turkey tail for Thanksgiving, and then I come home when the first dinner I came to, I said, I don't want no turkey tail.
How did you end up being able to use your arm again? Where did that come from, and how did you first get an idea that, hey, this may not be over here after all?
You heard about the guy, the farmer that picked up the calf and he ended up to be a cow?
I don't think I've heard that one.
Okay. You pick up the calf every day.
Yeah.
And finally you get to the point where it's a cow and you still pick it up. Well, you just don't give up. What are you going to gain if you don't? It's there. I got better. I remember the first job, I was holding some peaches and I put my hand underneath the box because I couldn't grab the cleat. And little by little, it came through. The reason I say I was driving truck, I'd work at commercials for so many hours a day and then take my truck at night and haul peaches, anything to make a buck.
I think you said earlier there was a moment where you felt a little twitch or something and you knew that there was still a chance there could be some muscle memory
my
there?
My bicep jumped, this one right here.
Uh-huh.
I would always try to jump it, and all of a sudden I noticed it was jumping. But this thing hurt. Right down here, all the way to San Francisco, when they hit the cool weather, the pain went away.
How has that affected you for the last 76 years?
Well, I ran my business. I ran 22 trucks. I built 2 cranes, and we did crane work for a number of years. Today, I go there once a week. They're busy as heck. It's hard to believe. It's hard to believe that 3 high school graduates would start a business like that, and today it's the customers like this. They like the way we did business.
I want to talk about that. A couple other things that I'm curious about as I just again try to imagine being you. You get hit, but because of the way the bullet came through, it didn't kill you, it didn't sever your spine. You may not be able to use your arm, but over that year in the hospital, a whole year in the hospital, yes. I think that's hard for any of us to fathom. What do you think it was
for that year that kept your mind engaged or kept your heart hopeful that there was something to look forward to?
I was going to get well.
I'm sure there are quite a few people that helped you too, huh?
Yes. But some of the people that I saw wounded, you know, when you're spread out like this and you got a bar going across and your leg and you got a bar going across there, you're nothing. You're just everything you do has to be. I feel sorry for those guys.
You saw guys in worse shape than you.
Worse shape than me. By far worse shape. I was at a reunion meeting. We used to go early. We paid our own way for the following year reunion. And we were sitting in Washington. This guy said, we were sitting at the table. All of a sudden, oh my God, a shrapnel falls out of his mouth. And that's at least 70 years ago.
Wow. And the day that you were wounded, there were guys from your outfit that were killed?
We lost, all told, 2,500 on both places.
Leyte and Okinawa?
Yes.
Were any of those guys who were killed guys that you knew very well?
Yeah, I got a list of them in my book. I think there was about 20 of them.
These are guys that you'd trained with?
Yes.
That you'd been around? Yeah. So then you're in the hospital for a year. You're in the hospital when this new weapon, the atomic bomb, gets used. You're in the hospital when Japan surrenders. What was that like, getting that news, being back here in a hospital?
Okay. When the war in Germany was over, I didn't go to town to celebrate that night because I've got the feeling of hurting for the guys that got killed. A few months later, when the war was over in Japan, again, I did not go to town and celebrate. You know, in those days, Fulton Street was a celebration street. You could drive down the street and pick up a friend or pick up a girl or whatever you want to do, and you had a date and celebrate. I didn't go to either one of them because I felt for the guys, for the four, especially the four guys in my outfit. Eddie Wanovich, number two gunner, always carried a little Bible. He got killed. John Preble got killed. Woodrow Rogers just got a divorce when he joined in our outfit. I didn't gamble, so people would ask me for money, and I would give them money. I didn't have that much, but anyhow, they'd ask me. So he told me one day, next time I see you loaning money to those guys, I'm going to block your head off. He said, say no to them. Well, I was a little bashful. I was a little afraid. Didn't want to say no. I hate to say the fact that he died because he was a pretty good guy. We had one, our number one gunner, that cooled down, and I got a letter from a captain to my mother. I'm doing everything in my power to get Joe back because I was so involved in the machine gun. Well, that never happened. But he wrote a good letter to my mother.
And the idea to start this new business after the war, whose idea was that?
My brother told me that if you make the last roll call, we'll start the business. Hey, kid, that's what he said. So I come home. Okay, I'm like, here I am. So we started with $2,000 apiece. Mm-hmm. $6,000, we started that business.
Did you think it would still be going 74 years later?
No. Today, my grandsons, graduates from college, except one, are there, and my son, doing a good job.
How different are the kinds of things they're doing now compared to what you did in the 40s?
The tools are different. The water jet, for instance, we used to have 24 torches. Now we don't have the torches. They're all water jets. Cuts through 3 inches of metal. Sand and water. Unbelievable. And the shears and the presses and all that. And an engineering department.
And I'm sure, you know, most people don't walk around every day thinking about how their life is related to a shop where people weld custom materials or applications for different businesses. But there are probably a lot of things you guys did in that shop and that they're doing there now that affect all of us, huh? What are some of the examples of things that we would recognize or things that affect us?
Everything breaks. Everything wakes, everything gets welded, whether it's cast iron, whether it's brazing, or whether it's reverse polarity, straight polarity. All the shipyards use reverse polarity. We use straight polarity. The welding is changed to a wire machine now. Before, it was all rod, about 12 inches long, and you use 1/8, 5/32, or whatever rod you should use. But now it's all wire machine. Occasionally, you will use a stick welder, but it's all roll the wire, and the reason for that is it carries its own flux. You've got a whole roll to use before you have to refill it. But the training stopped. There used to be a lot of training in high schools. That kind of died down. They're trying to bring it back up again. They're trying to prove that a welder can make just as much money as some professional people.
Well, and I'm just thinking, you know, when you say San Joaquin Valley, first thing most people think of is agriculture, you know, feed the world. Everything that grows, grows here. But in order for all that stuff to get processed and distributed, I think there's a lot of products that have to be built, a lot of machines that have to be built.
There's separating machines, vacuum machines. It's all on cleansing, whether it's water cleanse, whether it's air cleanse, graders.
You guys doing that kind of stuff back then?
Oh, yes, but not as much as right now. He sells all over the world. In the early days, the big fruit, people liked the big fruit because you could feed half the family. Today, they want small fruit so each person can eat his own. So that's where the graders and things come in.
They still don't like green peaches, though.
No, they don't. Although if you buy a green peach, just put it on the shelf, let it get ripe for about a week. It'll be all right. On the 7 buses that used to go out on the reunion, like in 1986, we had a reunion here in Fresno. We went to 7 different places. One of them was a green fruit shed. And he said, the owner says, I'm going to give each one of you a bag of culls. Well, the cull is the best fruit.
That's right.
It's ripe, ready to eat. It's not green. Everybody on the bus had a bag load of culls. Now, the culls aren't thrown away. The people cut them and dry them and sell them to Mariani and make big money with it. The American farmer, give him the go-ahead and then he'll do it. But the trouble today is all these housings on beautiful ground. We don't have that much ground. You know why? They think that we're supposed to get our food from China.
Well, speaking of your reunions, what has that meant to you over the years?
It got me away from my bashfulness. I'm not afraid to speak in front of 1,100 people. The togetherness of everybody. You know, whoever you saw there was one of our buddies.
I bet you learned a lot. You spent 8 days in combat and then a year in the hospital. A lot of those other guys were still fighting. They went over to Okinawa and went through all that there. I bet you learned a lot about those guys, too.
I got letters from them. They said it was very different. You know, the Japanese would not give in. They would rather fall on their own sword or on their own grenade. One of the first things that we all wished we could do over again, when an officer or a corporal was telling us all about a grenade, you know, and he's got the grenade in his hand, he pulls the pin, puts it back in, all of a sudden the grenade, he says, if the grenade ever falls, one person should volunteer and fall on it so that you save the rest of the guys. Well, he dropped this thing. And that smoke came out, and we ran in every different direction. He says, well, you really listened to me, didn't you? Do you understand what I'm telling you?
Yeah.
It was a lesson to teach you, you know. Well, fortunately, I knew how to swim. You'd be surprised how many people don't know how to swim. Mm-hmm. They would take us that could swim on 4, off 20, loading ship. Very interesting. So they had no meat ration then in Hawaii. So I'd always order a steak. And the first time I told the woman, I says, you know, most everybody likes a tender steak. I like a tough steak. So after a while, she come back to me. She says, I got you the tough steak, but why do you want a tough steak? I said, it'll last longer. And then I was in charge of a bridge. The last couple hundred feet, there was like a hog wire. It's like a hammock. If you walk, it'll throw you off. If you trot, you just go across there beautifully. So you tell every person that came, and I was in charge of that because I could swim. Sometimes, I won't mention the people, they would get down on their knees and start crawling. And the next thing you know, their pack would fall off into the water. Their guns would fall. I had to dive. I was a good diver then. I used to dive down underwater and bring it back up again. But it's amazing how many people can't swim. Thank God for the canal that ran behind our ranch. We swam in it every day.
And all those reunions you went to, I know one of them, you guys got a chance to go to Washington, D.C.
Yes.
And you saw the World War II Memorial, where they've got 4,000 stars representing 406,000 guys like you who didn't get to come home. What was that like? What did that mean to you? What did you think about when you were there?
It's a very serene feeling. It's an odd feeling. You know, why them? And why not us? You say that for the rest of your life.
You know, we talked about your business a little bit, but was there an element of it, a specialty that you really excelled at?
Well, I first started out welding and torch. But then when we got the lathe in, I started. His exact words were, "Kid, do you think you could learn to run that thing?" And I says, "Give me enough time at it, I'll learn. You know, you got to cut threads and everything. You got to pull this out, pull the little gear out, or push it in." And I joined it. The only thing is, as a welder, you can be a quarter inch off. On the lathe, you got to be thousandths.
Pretty precise.
With no training. And we ran 22 trucks alongside of that. We had two big harvesting units for hauling. They call it gondolas. Would start right about now and go till third week in October. You feel like you're on the bottom of a snake pit, but you get it done.
Well, what's worse, the bottom of a snake pit or on your back under a bush on Leyte waiting to see if they're going to kill you or not?
And you know what? Every night when I go to bed, there's clean white sheets, and I don't have to lay in that water. And you lay in this bed. I don't care if I lay there for a couple hours just going through everything I went through. I remember, of course, for 8 days, I remember every foxhole. I remember. It's easy to remember things like that because it was for the good. I was on 10 ships in that short time. I was in the service 10 months. I was in action. I got in February. 20th of October was our first action. We wanted to get home, see if we can find a wife, see if we can have some kids, maybe start a business or something. Put some money in the bank. Buy a new car. No. Buy a used car. That's why I will never build an old car, because I had enough of them.
Most of us alive today, most people listening to this, didn't live through World War II. Why is it important? Why does it still matter? And what should we understand and remember about what happened then?
If it didn't turn out the way it did, we would have lost our country. But you know what I'm proud of? I'm proud of the American youth. Dance hall boys, they called us. Yeah, we were dance hall boys. There was a dance hall in every corner. If somebody asked me, what is the best answer you want? How much more have I got? My brains are here, I could think. But I'm very happy that I've reached this stage. I don't know what did it. According to hospice, I was supposed to die in August. I had bad kidney. I listen to hospice's nurses, and I think through exercise, I walk up and down that ramp in front of my house 8 times, and I walk up and down the stairs 2x, and I stand up and down 20 times right here, and a few other exercises. I've done that since right after Christmas, every single day. Too proud to stop. I love it. I've always liked to go to gyms. I built Harold Zinkin's machinery. Oh, you know Harold Zinkin?
Sure, yeah. Invented the universal weight set?
Yeah, 1956, he came to my place. I was going to his place for exercise. He knew I had a shop, and he says, could I come to your place and take one of your men, like 4 hours a day? I got a machine I want to prepare. I says, okay. So he'd come. Whenever he'd come, I'd give him a man. He built the first 4-station machine. All of a sudden, one day I got a call from him. Can you produce the invoice for that machine? Yeah, I'm guessing 1956, I found it. So he won the patent. I did a lot of work for him. Probably 10 years worth of work. Harold Zinkin. Next thing I know, one day, I go home. Here's a complete machine sitting in my garage.
There's an example right there of how something your company did affected a lot of us. We didn't even know it.
Yeah.
Is there something, I know you're still looking forward. I can hear that. You're keeping on. But is there something when you look back over 96 years that you say, hey, that is what I'm most proud of or most thankful for?
My father's aggressiveness. They wouldn't give up for nothing. You know what they'd say? If a year went bad, they'd say next year. They always depended on next year. I thank commercial manufacturing for training me. It was something that they're in my prayers. I thank God for everything. I'm very religious. I've read this scripture here for 11 times. And the way some of it is written, some people would wonder, atheists, it can't be true. Well, you got to lean on something. You can't just say, I'll give it the time. When I read the crucifixion, and it's all spelled out all the way through, I know I'm putting a little religion into this, but there's a lot of religion in me. Thank the Lord. You know, if I played enough golf, whatever you do, if something goes wrong, you say, oh, God. So he's there with you. Oh, yeah. Oh, God. And I'm happy. My life is fun, and I've enjoyed every bit of it. So when the day comes, I want to find my wife someplace. It's got to be in heaven.
67 years? Sir.
67 years and 10 months. It was the best part of my life. Thank God I can keep going. My son asked me, how are you, Dad? I said, too good. And he said, Dad, every time I ask you, you say too good. How do I know how we really feel? I said, well, other than my kidney problem I had that disappeared, where'd it go? I don't know. So my life has been enjoyable.
Joe Garabedian, 96 years old. You'll find him once or twice a week still cruising around Valley Welding and Machine Works in Fresno, California, perhaps wearing his 96th Infantry Division Association hat. Don't forget to check out the pictures and video of Joe at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. And thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.